So why don't we go ahead and start, and then once Commissioner Chambliss gets here, we can approval of the minutes. So why don't we start by introducing ourselves, and we can start from the right today.
Jeff Clements, Council Research.
From Roundsville, Northwest CPAC.
Raymond Day, Southeast CPAC.
Daniel Henry, Chair Commission.
Tommy Carter, Council Auditor's Office.
All right, now that we've recognized everyone and we are foregoing approval of the minutes until we have a quorum, why don't we recognize any public comment that we may have? Is there any public comment? Seeing no public comment, we have a great invited speaker, Ms. Diane Mosier, who is a Director of Employee Services, and she's here to talk about employee computer access rights. So thank you so much, Ms. Mosier, and feel free to use the podium to talk about the issue.
Thank you for having us here today. I'm Diane Mosier, Director of Employee Services, and Employee Services is HR for the city. And then I have Paul Freeman, who is with the Information Technologies Division. And he's going to get into the specifics. He's the more technical person. I am going to start with the bigger picture, and so we'll start there, and then we'll delve into a little more detail. I also have my lovely assistant, Leah Hayes, in the back of the room in case we need to run out and go get anything to show you, but she's just here to assist us. But when to start with, so we've read, I want to definitely thank Jeff for pointing us to some audits that we looked at to make sure that we were addressing what the needs of this commission are. And it all starts with when an employee leaves. So that's the big picture, when an employee leaves. Back in 2016, we automated that process, and I have just recently sent out emails to every supervisor in the city that uses that process to remind them of what the process is. And we have a separation form that's computerized, and the supervisor actually starts with going to the city portal, and on the side of the portal is a departing employees link that they can click on, and under that link there are documents including checklists for what the supervisor is responsible for doing and then what the employee is responsible for doing, as well as a separation form. And the so the checklist actually tells the supervisor what they need to be doing, you know, that day that they receive the notification the employee is leaving, all the way to what they should be doing the week before and then the day of. And that triggers a separation form that is then electronically forwarded to different areas. So it goes to our time and attendance section so that they know that when the employee's last day is. It goes to the Information Technology Division so that they know to remove all access. Now, by what they remove is the city city access, not access that's external to what the city processes are. It goes to benefits, so benefits knows, and it goes to a few other places like that. So that's the start of the process. And again, I sent an email out reminding everybody of what the process was to make sure that everyone understood the process. So any questions about that? So far, I know that's real specific to the employee and them leaving.
Quick clarification.
Sure.
On the form that you said, the electronic form that gets sent out to those entities that you mentioned, is it like a web form? Is it like a PDF that gets sent via email once it's filled out?
It is a web form, and I actually have it right here with me. Would you like Leah to run and get copies? It's really only a two-page form. So the first part of the form says meet with the employee to secure signatures, provide employee services with hours of leave taken and hours worked in the last 2 weeks. So that's for our time and attendance. Attach or upload the resignation letter. Advise the employee to contact employee benefits. Verify address. And that's for like W-2 purposes in the future. If the employee was issued a cell phone or data device, request service termination or name reassignment from your cell phone coordinator. Reassign or reassigned to if it goes to a specific person. Secure city-issued employee ID badge, uniforms, keys, credit cards, issued paper, any overpayment of salary or other pays. So that's what kind of starts the process, and then it goes to each of the areas electronically, and then that triggers them to take action to remove access for the employee.
And this may be technical, I'm just curious. Is it like the web form, is it like a SharePoint web form? Is it part of iCloud? I'm just curious to see what kind of...
SharePoint, right. SharePoint.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So it's like using workflows in the background to send out the automated emails. Cool.
Yeah, those are the questions I'm not very good at. So that's the start of the process. We are also making other changes. I mean, you know, working for the city of Jacksonville, we appreciate our council auditors. They do great work. They always have to find something, and so we are constantly improving our processes. It's one thing that, you know, we know we're not perfect. And when I say we, I just use we collectively, every single department. Strive as we might to be, you know, as good as we possibly can. There are always holes in things the council auditors can find. And so a lot of times when they come in, they do, I'm going to just say, they do excellent work. We've certainly had a lot of audits done in our area, and we've made a lot of significant improvements because of it. So I do want to thank them for their good work, although sometimes it's a pain in the, well, you know what. But with that, we are also working on some other changes to access. I think I'm going to turn this over to Paul right now so you could get into a couple of the other changes that we're making.
Hey, Paul.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you all? Some of the other changes we're making. So one of the things that we noticed are looking at the various audits is employees who return to the city and those employees having access to systems that they had when they left. So to circumvent or deal with that situation, one of the things that we've decided to do is when the employee returns to the city, we will issue the employee a new ID. So, for example, my user ID right now is P. Freeman. So if I leave the city and come back, traditionally you would reassign me P. Freeman. Well, what was happening, as you all noticed, or the auditors noticed, is that when P. Freeman returns, he's having access. In some cases it may be appropriate, in other cases it may be inappropriate, right? So when P. Freeman, if I return to the city and they reassign me or give me a new ID, P. Freeman 1, then that new ID has to be reestablished, or access to various systems has to be reestablished. Therefore, P. Freeman 1 is just a brand new user, so whatever access that I need, all of that has to be set up when I return to the city versus me being able to return and use my previous ID and have access to systems that I had when I left.
Can I drill down on that one for a second?
Sure.
So let's just say I'm an employee of the city. I resign. Better job in the private sector,
okay,
or something. And then heartstrings come and I want to come back to the city and I get assigned the same ID that I did before. What was triggering them to inherit the access that they had before if it was taken away by ATD?
Well, when we say taken away, I guess I need to kind of clarify a few things. So you have systems that authenticate against Active Directory, which means that's the city's Active Directory is the user ID for city employees, right? So every employee is in Active Directory. You have systems that says if this employee is in Active Directory, and if I have a system over here that says I authenticate against Active Directory, which means that if this system says over here, if you P. Freeman for the city, you're going to be P. Freeman here because I'm going to come to the city's directory to see if you are P. Freeman. And if you are, then I give you access to the system. So when you deactivate P. Freeman, any system that is looking for trying to use P. Freeman will not have access to that system, right? Because P. Freeman has been deactivated from the Active Directory. you have systems out there that does not authenticate against Active Directory, meaning that I can be P. Freeman over here, but I can be P. Freeman 1 over here because my ID over here is independent of my user ID with the city. So because this system is independent of the city's Active Directory, I don't control what access that have. So to get one of the things that we're doing, we're going to look at establishing or doing a inventory of applications. So what we're going to do is identify every application that a city employee has access to, whether that application authenticates against Active Directory or whether it is discretionary-based access control system, meaning that it doesn't authenticate against Active Directory, right? So now, P. Freeman, you have an inventory of every system that P. Freeman touches. And so now that we have this inventory list that shows all applications each employee has access to, when that employee leaves, we now know that you got 20 systems that you need to go remove this employee from. And today we don't have that type of repository or database that shows us what system each employee has access to. So that's something that we're going to be working on.
So it's So based on what you're saying, it sounds like it's a one-way ping that an external system in a particular department may have that's outside of the city network.
Yeah.
That verifies that employee is active, and then once it sees that ID, then it gives them access, and that's the reason why you're having issues with returning employees, because if they use the same ID, it would have pinged them saying that they're an active employee and then grant them a whole bunch of access.
When they go to use that system, because that looks at Active Directory and it recognizes that ID exists, yes, so it sees that has a valid user to the system.
Is that the only way that certain systems outside of the city network would verify it's an active employee, or are there other ways that it does that?
It would be... That is the only way that I can verify. So let me just think of someone like risk management. So let's say they have this system that really doesn't even look at Active Directory, right? So what that means is that risk management, when they get a new employee, they put that employee in that system, right? They give them a username, they give them a password, and that employee uses that system Origami uses that system to do whatever they need to do, right? So if that employee leaves the city, then they have to go individually into that system and remove that employee because that is not authenticating against. I'm not saying Origami doesn't. I'm just using it as an example. If it didn't do that, they would have to go. And that's what we call discretionary-based access control systems. Those are systems that various departments, divisions can have that may not authenticate against Active Directory. I mean, moving forward, most systems that we're purchasing, cloud-based solution, things of that nature, those systems do authenticate against Active Directory. So as we move forward with technology just has changed, right? So a lot of applications, like when it was purchased several years ago, authenticating against AD, it just was not an option at that time for that particular vendor. Their system was not sophisticated enough to do that. But since then, like I say, so many with the cloud-based solutions, you definitely seeing more systems. I would say 9 times out of 10, any system you purchase today is going to authenticate against Active Directory.
No, that I got.
So based on, and I had asked this, I think before we had invited you guys here, but my question is, it's in you guys, you know, a lot. So anyway, so my question is, like, when you know someone's, you know, either fired or, you know, last day, what have you, why not have them to, you know, part of the out processing is, you know, you got to go see IT so they can, like, you know, eliminate your access to the system, period.
Well,
so that you don't have to worry about later on somebody, you know, accessing this, you know, going here and there and everywhere. I mean,
and I'm trying to see. I hear what you're saying. I'm just trying to see the best way to explain that issue. So, Because I'm IT, because of department division, they purchase systems that meets their needs, right? Makes sense. I'm fine. We're fine with that. When that system is implemented, let me go another way. As IT, when risk management purchases a system, I don't know which employees risk management gives access to that system because that's their choice. It's their division. They know I got John, Mary, and Sam. These are the three employees that I need to give access, and these are the roles that I need to find for those employees. As an IT, that's not part of my responsibility, so to speak. My responsibility is to say, when they reach out to me and say, hey, we need this application to authenticate against Active Directory, yes, I participate in that. So when that employee leaves, when I disable them over here, they automatically get disabled over here. The key thing is just understanding that all systems do not authenticate against Active Directory, and that's what creates some of your challenges. That's in a nutshell, really. That's what creates some of the challenges.
Have another, you know, I'm almost done. It seems like they should have another, way, you know, another barrier so that, okay, you know, everybody has this access to this and access to that, okay, but now you're about to leave. This is your last day. I have your badge, and I'm, you know, you're out. I'm just deactivating. You're totally out.
And,
you know, so that, you know, because I know, I understand different, you know what I'm saying, just, I guess a gateway, you know, to start off to everything. So I close that gateway, you know, here, then you can't get on risk, you can't get in that, you can't get in this one. That's my thoughts, but you're IT, yeah.
Yes, yes. But I think what gets us closer to the place you envision is having this application of this inventory of applications that shows us for each employee which applications they have access to. So I know that Paul Freeman has access to applications that authenticate against Active Directory, as well as those that does not authenticate against Active Directory. So now that I have this complete inventory that shows every system that Paul has access to as part of the process flow. Off-boarding. What we can do is
maybe that will work better.
What we can do is now, as part of that flow, we can have a list attached that shows John Doe has access to all of these applications, and that list goes to that supervisor, and that supervisor knows that they have the responsibility. They can double check or make sure that they deactivate that employee from systems that do not necessarily authenticate against Active Directory. And then one of the things that we want to do is send out like a 30-day reminder just to make sure that it has taken place. Hey, you've processed an employee out. Have you gone through and make sure that you have disabled them, their access from all of these systems?
It's the military, so I'm like, hey, look, can we just...
Go ahead, Val.
Coming from a private sector background, I'm just going to say this is ludicrous. That for years, if I understand what you're saying, this department, risk management, as you said, basically is not part of your IT.
Maybe I shouldn't say that. Maybe that's not the right word to say.
Don't have to change it yet. Leave it at that, and let's see if I'm taking it in the correct direction. So because they are risk management, perhaps the employee there has left and they didn't do what their due diligence and make sure that employee is removed access. You had nothing to do with that. So if they did not do their portion of what they were supposed to do to terminate access, then that employee could come back and would still maintain access. Is that a correct statement?
Yes, that's correct. But that's only for, and this is the thing that I think is key, discretionary-based access systems. So you have to look at it. You don't have to. But, you know, when you think about the city department and division, so you have systems way before we got advanced, right, that way before active directory became a term, this entity went out and purchased this system. When they purchased that system, they individually went in and defined those users with whatever role responsibilities they have to have. So just as they went in there individually and assigned them, they have to go in and individually remove them. It's just no way around it. That's how you remove them from the system.
But there was no checks and balances.
I don't know if I can actually say that, because I don't know what the checks and balances would be in the various each department division. You know, what their process would be when they, like, I can't tell you what risk management process is when they out-process an employee. I know part of that process is utilizing the form that Diane has indicated that, you know, the supervisors leave, and once they do that process, then from there, yes, the onus comes on them to make sure that this employee is completely processed out, which that includes a step to make sure that all system access is removed.
And how many of these, I'm sorry, and how many of these outside entities, or however you choose to refer to them as, are there? Are there like risk management or the departments or whatever that have their own
discretionary-based systems?
Well, it can be for any.
How many are there of these?
It can be any city department or division.
I see.
It can be any city department of division, right? Because each city department division has a unique function. So, however, sometimes that function is met by IT building a system for them. Sometimes that function is met by them going out to purchase a system. So when they go out to purchase a system, that's when we have to make sure that we have the checks and balances, boundaries, so to speak, in place to make sure that employees are properly out processed across all systems.
We're secure. That's what I keep seeing, is that there doesn't seem to be
security. No, that's definitely security. That's definitely
in
security.
Everywhere in the discretionary areas, non-discretionary areas, total security within. That's what it doesn't sound like, and so that's why I'm sorry I'm asking.
It's security from the perspective you have to think that if no one sets up your user ID, you don't have access to the system. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't just walk in a department or division and go onto a computer and try to log in because you don't have a user ID. So user IDs, users have to be defined, and when they are defined with certain roles and responsibilities based on the function that they serve in that organization, right? Because each role does something differently, and that's, you know, how setup is normally done with systems, and that's really a systems across the city in general.
And I just want to preface, we're not trying to...
Oh, no, I'm fine. Right. I'm fine.
We're exploring because we have the information.
Right. Yes.
Sorry, go ahead, Commissioner Day.
So as I understand it, this Active Directory system is sort of the norm. That's the standard now.
That's the industry standard now, yes.
And so some of our city departments and divisions within the departments are using software systems that don't interface with the Active Directory. They are discretionary-based systems. So my question to you is, who determines what type of system, what type of application the various units within city government use? Is that set by the administration, the department head, city council? Who sets the standard for the types of applications that should be used by our various city agencies?
Okay. So how the process works today is Diane comes to me and says to me, I need a new system that does A, B, C, and D. I says, okay, Diane, we need to meet and we need to define your business requirements, your system requirements, because we're going to put an RFP out on the street. And when that RPF goes out, it has to meet these certain standards, right? Now, today, what we do as ITD, we come up with what we have basic minimum standards that any application we purchase, it has to meet those standards. So one of our technical requirements is the system must have the ability to authenticate against Active Directory. So we have incorporated that standard into all of our RFPs that for future purposes that we do throughout the city, irregardless of what department division you're in. If you put an RFP, the standard is it has to meet these minimal security requirements and technical requirements and things of that nature.
That's the answer I was hoping for. So now let's go back to divisions or departments, subunits within divisions, who are using systems that do not interface that are still discretionary based systems. Why can't information technology division say, hey, it's time that you upgrade your system to one that does interface with Active Directory? Do these applications out there in the industry, are these the providers of the systems, are they aware that the Active Directory is sort of the industry norm, and are they going in and upgrading their system so that they interface with Active Directory? And do we as the city now require them to upgrade that system so that whatever application they're using now does interface with Active Directory? What is our position on that?
So, yes, you have a lot of vendors now today where they automatically give you updates, upgrades, and with those upgrades, you are seeing things of that nature, right? You have some systems that we are reaching out to the customers and we say, hey, this system, I mean, it's old. And so one of the things that, based on that, a budget request gets submitted so that they can get that system replaced so that they can be operating from modern technology. And that's really the goal that we push customers towards operating with modern technology. So that, and that can, like I say, once again, come through them purchasing a new vendor solution or meeting with ITD, working with ITD to develop them something in-house, a new system. And when we develop new systems, we, of course, develop them using the latest and greatest technology.
And my final question, two parts. Do we know how many discretionary-based systems are still being utilized in the city of Jacksonville? And have we set out a deadline within which the users of those systems have to upgrade to a system that does interface with Active Directory so that we can say that by the end of fiscal 22-23, which will begin October 1st, that by September 30th of 2023, the city of Jacksonville will be 100% compliant for all applications that interface with Active Directory?
We have not identified all applications at this point, at this time, in terms of do they or do they not authenticate against Active Directory, and that goes back to the inventory of applications that we are in the process of getting ready to start gathering this data so that we can know what is that footprint of all of these applications. And let me put it this way. It's easy for us to identify those systems that are authenticated against Active Directory. That's fine. That's a easy win. That is very easy. It's me needing divisions to make me aware of something, an application that they're not using that may not authenticate against Active Directory. So that's why we're doing this inventory of applications, because we see that as very key in terms of, as we moving forward, having things in place that help us to better manage, control employees having access or the proper access to systems.
Have we set a deadline by which everyone should be compliant?
We have not, and I think it's kind of hard to set a deadline without knowing exactly what that footprint is. I think once we identify that footprint, from there what we do is develop a project timeline, and then we say, okay, based on the footprint, we got 20 systems out here that needs to be upgraded, what have you, then we begin to work with those individual customers to come up with a timeline. Do you want to purchase something new? Do you want us to bill you something? Whatever that is, we just will go through that exercise with them.
When will your inventory be complete?
When would the inventory be complete? We're just starting the process. I think we probably can complete, identify everything, which within the next, I would say maybe.
Within the next 5 months.
Yes.
All right. And then once that inventory has been established, then you have the ability to go in and start requiring compliance and upgrades.
We have the ability to do that, and we also, it puts us in a better position to integrate that whole process or modify our enhance our out processing process, because now when that employee gets processed out, that would also include a list of those applications that that employee has access to.
I have a whole bunch of questions.
Okay, go ahead. Thank you.
I hate asking people what if questions because I know I hate it when people give me what if questions. But that being said, where does some private companies, cities, organizations, they have securities almost in a sense of risk management, or it's disaster recovery, or whatever nomenclature or organization likes to use. Does the city have some formation of that in ITD at all? In terms of, like, if God forbid something happens?
Yes, we have disaster recovery plans. So what happens if we've identified, if there's a major disaster, what is the process we follow? Who gets activated? Do we fail over to the data center in Atlanta? What process? So all of that, yes, we have disaster recovery continuity plans so that we can ensure that the city is in a position to continue operating its day-to-day responsibilities.
Okay. That makes me feel better. I figured that. So for the discretionary-based – who came up, by the way? But for the discretionary-based systems that you do not have a window into their existence in terms of what they are and where they – and what functionality they have, am I correct in assuming that? Or do you have an idea of the ones that you have yet to inventory what functionality they have?
We know what, I want to say this, I know what applications for the most part that exist within each division department, because as ITD, we support that customer. So I pretty much know all the applications that Liz or Diane's area is utilizing, because I provide some level of support, even if that to do patches to the server that they run on, what have you. So I know that information. I may not know off the top of my head if that is one that authenticates against AD, but I have a inventory of okay, here are all the applications that I support. Now, can I tell you all 8,000 employees, which applications they use? That's the piece that's where that inventory of applications is going to get me to that place. Now, only way I can find that information, I have to talk to my end user, Diane, to tell me, Diane, you have these 5 applications. Who in your department division has access to these applications? So I can tell Diane what application she has, but I need Diane to tell me who has access to those applications. So now I have a complete picture. I have, these are Diane's applications. I have, these are her employees who have access to those applications.
Okay, then just to clarify something that I'm a little confused about right now.
Okay.
Because you said that we're doing an inventory of all the discretionary-based systems within this calendar year so you can get a better idea as to what they are and where they exist with what department. That leads me to believe that there are systems out there that some departments may have that you don't know exist.
There's a possibility. There's a possibility you may have a few one-offs in that situation. Do I think you're going to have 1,000? No.
I didn't figure that.
No, you won't have 1,000, because at some point, some way, they normally need some form of assistance from ITD, even if they says we need this application is going to have to run on the server. Well, the only way it's going to run on the server, they're going to have to come to me. So for the most, now they do have, There's a possibility, for example, and let's just say somebody could have went out and purchased something in the cloud. Well, the cloud, you don't run on the server, it's running in the cloud. So you may find some one-off situations, but I don't think you're going to find like, oh, we had 500 applications that we didn't know about and they were running in this department. No, you're not going to find anything like that.
No, that's not where I'm going. I guess, Mike... So the company I work for, I work for Citizens Property Insurance, and I'm on their purchasing team. And whenever we're doing solicitations, because we have to follow the state's procurement code, there are standard questions that we have to ask when it's a technology software that we're purchasing. And one of the questions is asking as to whether or not the data will be hosted on our internal servers or that vendor's internal servers. And whether city data in your case will live on that vendor's host servers or their cloud. So you're getting that information for new systems. My concern is, do you know for the discretionary based systems that you don't know that exist, that those vendors may be hosting city data on their servers or their cloud that you're unaware of?
Is that a possibility you're asking me? Possibly could, possibly, but I just think if we find that situation, I do honestly believe it's going to be a very, very small population just because of the process that we have in place. Because normally, for example, most purchases that we do, we have to go through procurement. If you go through procurement, you have to put out an RFP. If you put out an RFP, you have to come to me as ITD to add those technical and security requirements. Because if you're going to host our data, we need to know that it's secure. We need to know what happens if, you know, you lose it. I mean, where's your backup? It's all of those technical details we get into to make sure that the city data is protected. You know, if there's an outage, how quickly can you get me back up? You know, if you lose a backup, I mean, what's your process? So we have our security information officer. We drill them on this or making sure that we're covered when we go through that RFP process. And even when we get into the contract negotiations with the vendor, we make sure we have some solid language in there because we want to protect the interest of the city.
I have no concern that you're not doing that for everything moving forward. I get that. I guess what I'm honing into is that there seems to be a small universe of systems that probably were grandfathered into whatever policy that is established in terms of how you bring in new systems into the city network or for users to use that didn't get this same screen that you're describing, possibly. And I just want to know that while you're doing the inventory for these discretionary-based systems, that's part of that inventory of questions that you ask, so that way you make a risk assessment on these new systems that you're just finding out about.
Yes, because one thing that we will know is, based on the system, we quickly able to identify, is this a system that runs on our server? Well, if you're running on the ITD or the city's infrastructure, we know you're getting daily backups. We know that you're protected. We know those things, right? Because you're running on a city server. And when we think about more of the cloud technology, what that came into play within the last, 3 to 7, 8 years, what I mean? So we know the new cloud technology. We definitely know that for the most part. I believe we're protected, right, because of the process we followed. And for the older stuff, that stuff that's running on our servers, running from our data center, so we know we're protected in those regards as well.
Okay, so because these old systems weren't created in a time, this will finish it, weren't created at a time where there would have been cloud technology or the possibility of them being hosted on a vendor's servers, you don't feel like it's as much as a risk that you would expect when you find out what these systems are?
No, because also one of the things you have to keep in mind with these systems that, although I refer to them as running on older technology, and I don't know if I'm not sure if that's the best word. One of the things that we've done over the years is that we've had to upgrade these systems, right? Because, I mean, it's 2022. I can't have a system running on a 2000 server. I can't have a system running on a 2000 SQL database. So over the course of time, you know, just like we had an initiative where we've upgraded everything to like a 2019 SQL database or higher. So over the course of time, it's just some of them you have to do an upgrade because they're just not going to continue to function.
Yeah,
so
and they're expensive
to maintain. We've done that type of upgrade work in the past as well.
Okay. Final questions. Moving forward, if a department wants to purchase a system, technology, I don't know, let's say they want to get DocuSign or something. I'm just using that as an example. I know that it will host on DocuSign servers. You buy the license or the licenses. The department is the one that assigns the users, and then they would use it for stuff like that, that will never be hosted on the city servers, will never ping Active Directory. Do you know about when those happen right now?
Yes, I know about those, yes.
And then you make an inventory of those as part of the types of
yes,
systems?
Yes, because those, they're going to have to come through ITD, and I tell you why, because for those, you're talking about an enterprise solution for the most part, right? So if we do DocuSign, most times we're trying to use that throughout the city because that means we're moving in a direction where we're going towards electronic signatures. So we're not going to do electronic signatures only for employee services. We're going to want an enterprise license agreement so that every city department division that needs to do electronic signature, they're able to leverage that. And so with that, that's going to be built into our contract and our negotiations, and we're going to understand, you know, because we want to know, you know. So when I sign this document and it's somewhere in the cloud, I need to understand how protected it is, right? I need to make sure it's not sitting somewhere where anybody can breach your system. So we want to understand what type of security measures that DocuSign or whoever else have in place to protect the city's data.
And the retention policy that the city may have is part of that questionnaire as well?
Yes, we definitely take into consideration retention policy because every department division have a different retention policy, right? So I know, like, for example, I think her stuff is, what, 50 years? They 50 years. Well, you have another area over here may only have 7 years.
Okay. Final question. Sorry to be pestering you. I understand that any kind of upgrade for these old systems, the discretionary-based systems, is going to cost money, is going to be an appropriation. And I was trying to read into what you were saying when you say once you identify it, you'll talk to the end user, the department's responsible. And then I insinuated you were saying that they'll decide one way or another whether or not they want to integrate into something that will...
They decide if they want to build or buy.
Okay.
I'm building it internally as ITD. By they've identified a product on the market that satisfies at least 90% of their day-to-day end user requirements.
And those are the only two options, or is there a third option for them to keep status quo?
No. Third option doesn't exist.
Okay.
Because as certain technologies reach end of life, because one of the things that we're always looking out and watching out for is, has this reached end of life, end of support? Because if it reached end of life, end of support, it is something that we have to quickly get you off of, you know, so because we don't want you on the system that Microsoft says. So Microsoft says, and this is an example I can use, when Microsoft says, hey, we're no longer going to support a 2000 server, well, I'm quickly moving all of my customers off that 2000 server because I don't want to be in a position where you have an issue and I can't call Microsoft and get support because Microsoft say you're on a 2000 server and you have to be on a list of 2008. So we pay attention to all of those things, our security information officer, and we constantly watching what's reaching the end of life and what do we have that's running on the infrastructure so that we can begin our upgrade process.
So to that point, I know every kind of thing costs money. So once you do the inventory, fast forward 5 months, you've identified what's out there. You give them the option of whether or not they want to purchase or build inside. Who's responsible for making the budget requests for these upgrades one way or another? Is it the individual departments? Is it ITD as a whole? How would that cost?
In some cases, it can be ITD, but in some cases, it can be the end user. It's going to depend on what the request is per se, you know, because sometimes it could be where we need to do something from an enterprise level across the city for infrastructure, network, whatever that may be. You know, so that's going to come from ITD. If it's an individual system that an area is using to meet their day-to-day business functions, then that's most likely going to come from the end user or that department, that division, I should say.
Okay, so us as a commission, if fast forward from now, you come up with the inventory report and you make the assessment, end user by end user, I'm trying to see, I would want us to advocate for city council to make sure that these departments in ITD has the resources to implement these changes and they don't just end up on a list of nice budget asks that we may have to ask for but never get funded.
I don't think you're going to be in that position because if we as a city allowed ourselves to stay in that position, we invite our own security risk, and we're never going to position ourselves where we're trying to invite security risk.
So I take that statement to say that ITD will then be advocating for whatever resources or appropriations are necessary to make these changes?
Yes, we would. Because it's just certain things, yes, we don't ever want to be in. Our goal is always to make sure that we are having or operating in the most secure environment that we can operate in, because especially when you look at everything that's going on today, right? So security is just one of our top concerns. So we are always working towards to make sure we have the most secure environment and the most secure systems. So, you know, we actually, our security department, we do what we say vulnerability checks. So if we see vulnerabilities, we automatically address those things. So, we're definitely going to be a strong advocate for making sure that we get the system upgrades, system replacements, whatever those things are, just to make sure that we're operating in the most effective, efficient manner possible.
Administration is aware?
Yes, the administration knows that we are working on this.
Follow-up question. How much have you requested in the budget that will be adopted at the end of September for your initiatives?
I'm not sure of anything. I can't speak of anything has been requested.
Okay, so you have to wait until the fiscal 23-24 budget to fund these upgrades?
I wouldn't say that necessarily, because sometimes what you have to do is we have those discussions, and some departments, some divisions are able sometimes to find funding or move funding, what have you, based on the need. And then sometimes if we just have to go to the office, the administration to, hey, say, you know, this needs to be addressed, then they have that discussion and a normal decision is made. Because, I mean, just based on my experience, I've never seen the administration allow us to operate with a vulnerability if it's brought to them. So if we bring it to them and knowing that this initiative is underway, then I'm just thinking we're going to get the support that we need, because we're talking about, you know, making sure that the infrastructure, I don't want to say the infrastructure, but application systems are operating in the most secure method or manner that they can.
Your division reports up to the Finance and Administration Department, is that correct?
This is correct.
So historically, you were part of the old Department of Central Services in the early days of consolidation.
I don't think I was ever.
Okay, that's just.
I was there then.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Encyclopedia of knowledge.
Okay.
I was around when I was
okay.
A kid, but I was around.
Okay. Okay.
There on the first day in Mayor Tanzer's office. Yes, I was there. Thank you.
Any other questions?
No.
not satisfied. I still think that there should be a way. Now you talk about vulnerabilities. I think that's a vulnerability when people still have access and they're gone. You know, and I know you say you guys can't. I mean, I'm not saying you can't, but I just hope that, you know, in future they will develop something so that, again, I know that maybe it's, you know, right now, because the supervisor's job to say, okay, this person has left, let me send you a list so I can let you know to go ahead and, you know, disable them or what have you. But I think it should be another, again, I'm not a technical person, but I feel that it should be like a gatekeeper from the beginning. So when that happens, I can go ahead and chip you off so you can no longer get into anything. You know, a checker with another checker.
Okay. So let me say this.
That's just me.
But most, all access starts with getting access to the city's network. Once you're terminated from the city, you have no access to our network.
How do they ensure that?
Oh, because I disable you. I disable you. If my manager says Paul Freeman is leaving tomorrow, immediately at 5 p.m. tomorrow, my access is turned off. I am disabled. When I leave here tomorrow, I will not be able to get access to the city's network. If I go anywhere and try to get, because remember, everything starts with coming into the city network. So if I can't get into the network, I can't get access to any system. Now, once you bring, I think that's the best way to say it. It all starts getting into our network. You cannot get into our network once you terminate from the city. Now, that's one thing I can assure you, when you leave, your access is turned off.
Better not.
Oh, yeah. Like, no, everything starts getting into our network. Because think about it. That application is running on our server, right? So everything starts getting into our network.
Not all of them.
Well, not all of them, but no, I mean.
I don't mean to be a buzzkill.
So let me just say this, though. If you don't come into our network, if you're a cloud solution, 9 times out of 10, you're authenticating against Active Directory. Well, when I disable you from my network, even if you go to this cloud solution and try to get in, the cloud solution is coming to Active Directory trying to see is P. Freeman there. Well, P. Freeman is not there because P. Freeman has been turned off when he left the city. So you still won't be able to get in.
Sounds better.
Okay.
Right. In my dream world, because I know so, private industry is a lot different from government, so I get that. But in my dream world, the city has single sign-on.
Yes.
You cut off everything. The systems all talk to each other. There's no ambiguity. You don't have to do a checklist. That's my dream world.
Right, but, and that's an excellent point, and that's exactly what Active Directory really is in a nutshell, is single sign-on, right?
But in the sense, it's not a one-way ping.
Yes.
I want it to work both ways. I don't want the risk where you have to create a new employee ID to ensure they don't inherit old access if they're a returning employee. I want that access to be removed, zeroed out, erased, so you don't have to create a new employee ID if someone's returning. I know that's a small case because there may not be a huge universe of employees coming back, but still.
Okay. Let me clarify. We are definitely exploring this as we go down this road of creating a new ID for P. Freeman, if we run into challenges or if we feel like able to say, oh, you know what, there's a different way, a better way we can do this, then we will do that way. But right now that is the option that we are exploring, because we definitely recognize that option automatically eliminates any excess that I've had. And that's a quick win, I know, to, you know, if I leave tomorrow and I come back Monday and they make me P. Freeman 1, all of my stuff has to be redefined. So I can't come back in and have access to something that in procurement or risk management or whatever. I just won't, because they've disabled that ID P. Freeman. So P. Freeman 1 has to be set up to make sure that P. Freeman, now that he's in the new department division, he's actually getting what he needs. And so that was a way that we could quickly ensure or deal with this issue of employees who were leaving.
Okay. Any other questions?
All right. Okay. We're sensitive on time, so I want to make sure that we give you the break that you need. Is it a possibility for you to provide a write-up of the inventory process of what the current plan is, so we can have that documented at least for our sakes, so we know what the plan is, what it involves, and then what the end solution is projected to be, so when it's 5 months from now, we check back in, we can base off of what we said was going to happen and what actually happened.
Okay.
Okay.
Could we request them to give us an update at our January 2023 meeting?
Okay, 2023 meeting.
We would invite you to come back and give us a report on your inventory.
Okay.
And if you can include how you deal with internal promotions, so someone not necessarily leaving the city, but they may go from human services to ITD and they may have access, how you deal with that as well. Because we didn't get a chance to talk about that, but there's no time to.
Okay. And give me that example again.
Someone gets promoted to another department, they may have access.
So I get promoted from ITD to employee services?
Yeah, but that's I may have had access to discussion.
That's the example you want me to?
Internal movement.
Yeah. Yes, thank you. Yeah.
Okay.
Because that's something that came up in the audit reports, and we didn't get a chance to talk about it, but I don't want to talk your ear off because I can keep on going, but we're out of time. Thank you so much, Ms. Mosher.
Thank you very much.
Both of you, all of you. I know we were kind of intense.
I don't know whether or not it helps, but this is something that we've been beating around for the last 4 or 5 years. So this is the first opportunity we've ever had to actually drill down to it with actually someone that knows what the process is. So I'm glad we finally found you.
Okay. Thank you.
She put him out there. Wow.
You're the SME in this situation.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. All right, let's speed this through.
And along what you said, it might be better. I mean, the 5 months is up right at the end. Give them an extra month, February, to come back. And at that time, hopefully, they would have more of a. I've had a chance to really go through it and then really come back with, this is what we're going to do. Just giving them the opportunity, because I know we can.
That would be fine with me. Yeah. We invite them to our February 2023 meeting.
Were there any other questions that you wanted them to answer in the interim?
No, I think they pretty much. Happy with the answers, but those are the answers. Hopefully giving them the extra, you know, time once they do the applications and then have it.
Tommy, do you anticipate any audits, follow-up audits?
You're in my head.
That would be occurring to address, so this was identified in a previous audit. Do you guys then go back, say, in 90 days to reevaluate what progress has been made? Really? Okay. All right. Unless there were to be a request from someone in City Council. So a member of City Council could initiate a request to the City Council auditor on a specific topic. Thank you. I just want to make sure if the City Council had that discretion to say, hey, we think this is worthy of additional follow-up.
The one thing I found interesting, I guess to myself, I find many things interesting. Whenever your office produces the reports and we find these intricacies, I'll say that, there's always a detailed template that's used to explain the issue and how they plan on correcting it. I'll say it that way. It's usually fairly consistent. But up until this point, there was I had no clue, or at least in the reports the office has issued, I had no clue that this inventory was occurring. And I'm just curious, did you guys know that this was happening? Because it didn't seem like it's come up in any of your reports.
I don't know the answer to that question. Me personally, no, I did not know. Typically, we would have, well.
Okay. I just, one thing is consistent about the city is that when there's an issue and you need to explain it, it's always consistent in terms of what's said and what's explained and how they plan on fixing it. And I usually aren't really surprised. So when he said it was doing the inventory, I thought that was great. I was just shocked that no one, I didn't know about it, or it didn't come up in any audit that occurred, which may be possible because when you ask these questions, I don't imagine you ping ITD and ask follow-up questions about access. It stays with that particular department that they're auditing, right?
Times when they work with ITD.
But you're free to do your report when you're ready.
Through the chair to the commission, the council auditor's office has not released any reports since the last true commission meeting. Our office currently is fully focused on reviewing the mayor's proposed and independent agency budgets for fiscal year 22-23. Just as a side note, the finance committee budget hearings begin on August 11th, 2022, and 5. That's
on today.
You all have that in the bottom of your stack.
No questions. That concludes my report.
Thank you. Concise.
So this is a fun season for yourself?
That's correct.
If we want to... I know you gave us a schedule, Jeff, but for these individual departments that are coming up, I know sometimes the handouts pull out that department from the budget so that way they can look at it. Is that available somewhere for us to get those pull outs so that way
yes.
we don't have to try to find it?
Everything is going to be on the City Council website. Go down to the bottom to Hot Topics and then click on Budget. And that will take you to the calendar. It will take you to the mayor, the PDF of the mayor's proposed budget, all of the council auditors, departmental analyses will be on there. Anything that gets handed out at a meeting will get put on there attached to the meeting.
Then when did they have to approve the millage? Rollback, I guess they want to do.
That'll be, well, they've already approved the preliminary millage, which is rolled back, is reduced by an eighth of a mil. And then they'll do the final millage levy when they do the budget at the end in September.
But the millage rate, the rollback, that 1/8 mil that was already adopted, that is, provides the basis for the trim notices.
Right. So that's all that has been, or they will be mailed out any day now, probably.
September, yeah, usually.
And as the council auditor always says every year when we do this, that adopting the preliminary millage rate basically sets the cap for the highest you can go, because to raise it later, you would have to re-notice everybody, every property owner in the city, at the cost of several hundred thousand dollars to send the notices again. Always go lower, but you can't practically go higher once you've done the preliminary.
Questions for...
Yeah.
Green man, Tommy. All right. Mr. Roberts is not here for legislative tracking, but just for the sake of the record, is there anyone that saw any particular bills that they're interested in that they wanted to discuss? Okay. I don't have chair's comments other than making sure that you don't have to wait 5 months to actually get what the plan is first regarding the inventory. Hopefully that didn't sound like that's what we were saying. But I want both ends so that way I know that it's actually, we're doing an inventory. I just want to make sure it's, I'm not doubting the veracity of anything that you said. I just want to make sure it's
fleshed out. Put more meat on it. Yeah.
Yeah. So why don't we go into old business and the sheriff's office staffing report? Yes, why don't we go ahead? So Commissioner Chambliss joined earlier in the meeting, so we now have a quorum. I'd entertain a motion to approve the minutes from May 5th and June 2nd.
Move approval of the minutes as presented.
Thank you. I have a motion and a second. Any discussion? None. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right, old business. We still have the existing old business item on the Sheriff's Office staffing proposal, and I see that there's some handouts, so imagine someone wants to talk about the proposal.
I would.
Go ahead.
So the gist of this report is it's the same format that I presented. Oh, gosh, I forget now, February, maybe. However, I took Mr. Roberts' advice, and rather than just simply using the state average as the metric, I dug a little bit deeper, and I said, well, if we're really going to make the argument that Jacksonville is an urban city police department, that JSO really is an urban city police department, let's use the four larger, let's go take the top five cities in the state. We are the largest city in the state by population, followed by Miami, Tampa, Orlando, and St. Petersburg. So when I took into account the populations of those four cities and the number of sworn law enforcement officers for those four cities, the average, that ratio of officers per 1,000 residents is well above the state average. It's actually 2.73. So I have set that as my target. Concurrently with that, JSO fell from 1.96 officers per 1,000 in 2020 to 1.9 in 2021. That's in essence, on a base of about 1 million people, that's roughly a loss in officers of 60 that we don't have due to growth. And so what alarms me is the deficiency in staffing. So we approach this in two ways. What is the current deficiency? And I determined that by taking that average of what I call the four major cities of 2.73. And we take the current staffing that Sheriff Williams, now former Sheriff Williams, presented to us in October of last year. Of 1,827. So based on the 2.73 standard, the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office should consist of a force of, where's my number here? Excuse me. There should be 2,592 positions in order to meet that 2.73 ratio. We actually have, in the current fiscal year, when he spoke, we had
1,827 positions out of, I think it was 1,845 budgeted positions. So the target of 2,592 subtracting the 1,827 creates a deficiency of 765 positions. If you were to look at this city compared to the average of the four other major cities. On top of that, we know that we are growing at about 2% per year. If we want to maintain that 2.73 per 1,000 ratio, then we're going to need to add about 52 officers annually. This is above and beyond retirements. So that additional 52 officers per year, and we know we have a deficiency of 765, and we also know from listening to Sheriff Williams that we cannot hire that many officers in 1 year and put them on the street, that this is going to have to be a multi-year process. The original analysis that I did and that original deficiency of 396 using the state average, since it has now increased dramatically, it's impossible to do this over a five-year time frame. We just don't have the capacity in the police academy. So I said, okay, I'll stretch it out 8 years. And on an eight-year time frame, by adding those 52 officers per year, we're going to have to add, on top of the deficient positions, we are going to have to add 416 additional officers over the next 8 years, plus the deficiency of 765. So over an eight-year process, we are going to have to add 1,181 new positions, or about 148 positions per year, to be fully staffed at that desired metric of 2.73, and we do that in fiscal year 2029-2030. So this is mind-boggling to think that we have to project out 8 years to meet a standard for the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, but that's what my analysis reveals. We know that from our earlier discussions, it takes about $100,000 per officer. So based on that initial 148, the first year commitment of funding is going to be $14,800,000. Over the eight-year period, we know we also have to contend with inflation and a moderate inflation rate of 3%, which may be too low, but we'll go, for the sake of discussion, that's the number I'm using. So over that eight-year time frame, I have broken down annually from $14,800,000, it goes to second year, $15,244,000, $15,701,000, $16,172,000, on out into the eighth year, where that commitment will be $18,202,133. Over that aggregate build-up period, the aggregate cost is estimated at $131,606,573 for an average annual cost over that eight-year period of $16,450,821. So how do we pay for this investment in public safety? Well, over the four-year period ranging from fiscal 2019-2020 to the 2022-2023 fiscal years, our ad valorem tax revenue grew an average of about $65,000 per year. The lowest that the ad valorem tax grew in any 1 year was $52,800,000. Well, the initial year, the second year, it was about 40-something million, but over the time frame, because this year alone, it grew $98 million. And I don't think it's prudent to try to plug in a spending approach using the high number. So I've gone with a conservative approach and using the $52 million number. So if our average marginal growth in ad valorem tax revenue stays at about $52 to $53 million a year, we would be using 31% of the marginal ad valorem tax revenue growth in order to fund this initiative, which leaves the other 69% of the ad valorem tax revenue growth for other needs in the city, and there are many. So based on this, my proposal would be that we recommend to the City Council, starting in the current budget for the fiscal 22-2023 budget, that we initiate this increase in staffing to the Sheriff's Office by creating 148 new positions to be funded in the 2022-2023 budget, growing by 148 every year thereafter until the eighth year, when fiscal 2029-2030, we have achieved the targeted staffing of 1,181 new positions. So, obviously, this major staffing deficiency in JSO is going to call for competing needs in this public investment from city resources. One of those competing needs is the buildup in the co-responder program. Starting in April of 2022, the city of Jacksonville received a $10 million grant. This is funded through Lutheran Services of Florida. And it's a three-year grant, on average about $3.3 million per year. It funds a co-responder clinician in each of the six zones for one of the watches. When I last spoke to Sheriff Williams, and this was ironically shortly before he departed, he indicated that there is some indication that there may need to be some additional clinicians brought on board, but he felt it was too early to really identify that. But I want us to be aware that if we will simply maintain the grant that's in place, starting in 2025, the city will need to absorb that approximately $3.3 million cost. But I believe that based on what I'm seeing in our ad valorem tax revenue, we have that ability. This city has the ability to fund the mental health co-responder program. It has the ability to fund the buildup over the eight-year period to resolve the staffing deficiency in the sheriff's office. So I maintain my original position that we do not be diverting funding from the core functions of the sheriff's office in order to fund the co-responder program. We have the ability to fund it and to fund the buildup in the sheriff's office. So I reiterate that, in my opinion, it's not a time to defund the police. This is a time for our community to stand united and increase our public investment in law enforcement to create safe neighborhoods. And these are the goals that I will continue to pursue during my tenure on the TRUE Commission. So I would move that we adopt a resolution encouraging the City Council to begin adding 148 new positions to the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office beginning with fiscal year 2022-2023. That is my motion.
Second to that motion.
What I'm listening to, I do agree. With that, probably you didn't budget for that. You didn't talk about that. But we definitely, once you get more, I love about citizenship, about having clinicians there. I do love that. I think it's definitely powerful. I also talk about, we talked about it before when we talked about the JSO and what have you, about training, proper training with the police officer. We're going to have to do that as well.
And we can't do that without increasing the staffing, because if we really want to have a sheriff's office, and we'll need a second on the motion to have discussion, but you know,
I'll second it.
Okay. So my position has been that we cannot have the quality of officers that we all want, and for them to be treated fairly in terms of compensation and benefits, without having adequate staffing. Because, and I can share this with you, the last time I met with the sheriff, I met with him in his office, and there's a huge screen on his wall in the office of the sheriff. And at the top right-hand corner is the number, and I don't remember the number off the top of my head, the number of calls for service that are in process. Immediately below that number is a number in red, and those are the calls for service that are waiting. Every hour of the day, that number is red, meaning that there is a deficiency every hour of the day in terms of calls for service versus calls for service that are being answered. And we simply can't turn that red number into a zero without adequate staffing. So that's why I'm taking the position that we can't meet that need, plus have the slack resources where officers are able to get off duty to do the training. Right now, our officers, under the current union contract, I think they're granted 2 weeks a year off duty for training time. Any other training is either not occurring or it's having to occur during on-duty hours, which further erodes the ability of the sheriff's office to meet calls for service. And if we really want to have safe neighborhoods from, you know, Baldwin to the beaches or from Mandarin to Moncrief, we have to have adequate numbers of officers in JSO, and that's what has motivated me to take this position.
I agree with that. Just that I would just again say to include.
And we could.
They take it from one budget, you know, to another budget, you know, to make it happen. That's good, but they have to have some training. They've got it. They have to have that. That's a must.
And, you know, the sheriff's office grew. I don't know the number off the top of my head, but I haven't looked at it. But I did see some news articles. They're something, I want to say, in the magnitude of $40 million is the recommended increase in the JSO this year. Not a single new position. Okay, I'm told that a lot of that is for technology. But on top of this, as we beef up the staffing, we need to make the city council aware, and hopefully the new sheriff will make the city council aware, and the new mayor will make the city council aware, that they do need to address training.
Along with that, you know, building a better relationship with the community. That's a big one there. It's just so much, you know. It's
exactly.
So much. Which
gets back to the deficiency in staffing, because they can't, if they're every minute of their watch that they're out answering calls for service, there's physically impossible for them to take time away to go in and stop in and, you know, start building relationships and start that community oriented policing. And it's just anecdotally, you know, I've spoken with some of the officers, and we're at a breaking point in terms of the morale, and I don't know the number, we could get it, but you know, I'm told it's like 40 to 50 per month who are just saying, you know, I'm leaving either through retirement or resignation, which further exacerbates this staffing issue, and we simply have to address it. And this proposal does nothing to address levels of compensation, levels of benefits. Those are corollary issues to the fundamental issue of staffing, adequately staffing the sheriff's office. That's why I made the motion.
Calls that come in, there's no. Something done about how our improvements we must figure out something to do on part of that technology we're improving. All of that is part of the budget, so I guess how do you encompass all of that to make changes within the show? Because we have to come up with some kind of answers to happening all over the city. If you listen, it's happening everywhere. So there has to be something. I don't know what the answer is, but there, that has to be addressed as well within the whole JSO budget.
Thanks, so. One of the things I really wanted the final product to also have, and if it's here, you tell me, because I've just been skimming while you've been talking, is the KHA intervention component that we wanted to be in sync.
I looked at that, and I met with Michael Weinstein and two others of his staff members, and they are spending, I think the number is around $31 million a year in programming. Mike said that you simply cannot say that because, and I did some projections, and I came up with, based on the number of clients being served at the present funding levels, and I did some extrapolations based on the new census data, and the number of youth, and it's primarily between the ages of 5 and 18, although I think it's actually 19, is the age ranges, that you can't do a simple extrapolation of a linear projection that, okay, if we're serving X number and the total number of population in that cohort is 4 times that. He says it doesn't necessarily take for each marginal student or youth being served, it doesn't necessarily take the same dollars, that as you, that if you start serving the higher risk youth first, those where there is no intact family, where there is no head of household that's headed by a single mom who's working multiple jobs, those are the categories with the highest risk factors. But that as you move out that population cohort, the risk factors drop off. So the marginal cost to serve those populations begins to drop off. So you simply can't extrapolate out. Then I also found out that, you know, this is just Kids Hope Alliance. This doesn't take into account the nonprofits that are out there serving at-risk children. And this doesn't take into account what the state funds, like programs through Daniel Memorial, which is the oldest child service agency in the state of Florida, dating back to the 1880s, I think it is. So I just said, well, you know, there's just no way that I can get my arms around this. So I would propose that that become the next project that we undertake in terms of a more detailed analysis, and I'm willing to continue working on that. But I simply, at some point, I said, and then especially when I got the new data from 2021, and I said, "Oh, this is even worse than I was expecting." So, and again, the 2.73 is a goal. You know, there may not be the political will by the city council to take this step. That's, you know, that assumes that we on the commission adopt this proposal that we can then present to the city council.
So you have to look at training, you have to look at, you have to look at intervention. Also, one of the things I talked to someone I just met last week on this, talking about, you know, dealing with the inner man, the individuals, you know, some of these kids are broken. Like, you can put them in these different programs, but you still have to deal with their mental health part. It's a holistic approach. You have to deal with the work officers, you know, that love to get that program by what's called the
co-responders.
Co-responders, I love that. And then you have to look at intervention.
The co-responders.
All of this have to come together, yep, to try to get some kind of improvement. It's just not a one way. It's like a pie. It's a big, you know, circle. We have to deal with holistically.
The co-responder piece was relatively easy. It's a relatively small grant. It probably has room for expansion. Mike felt like it was too soon to propose expansion, but he felt that that's where it was going to be headed. And I think that we can see through I think the overall projection for the city in terms of revenue growth, I think, is very positive. We know we're growing. We know that we have development that is taking lower taxed because it's lower valued property. And after it's developed, it now becomes higher value, which yields higher dollars, even at the same millage rate. So, you know, I feel confident that we do have over the next 10 years looking out, even if we're talking about, you know, an average of, you know, $60 million a year over the next 10 years, we have a pipeline of revenue that's approaching $600 million over the next 10 years. And I'm sure there are going to be other needs that will be competing for that. But I think once we get the sheriff's office deficiency addressed, then and at some point, then, you know, that average of $16 million a year, we don't do that anymore, because all we're doing now is keeping up with adding that 50 positions a year. So now the marginal growth in the sheriff's office is going to start approaching the 4 to 5 million range. And then once we hit the target staffing, and as we monitor our population and the various programs, and this, we're potentially talking 2 sheriffs from now, before all of this is fully realized, or at least one sheriff. The new sheriff goes out 8 years, and then then a new sheriff after that. So we're talking potentially out into the sheriff that will take office in 2031.
Are you? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, do you think the co-responder program is at a point? What they would think would be the next steps, how many more we would need, how it should be expanded.
I don't, it's not even 6 months old yet. I don't know that, no. See, it didn't start until April, and we're not even in October, so it's not even 6 months.
Well, I thought it started during COVID.
There was a co-responder in COVID, but this grant didn't start, this $10 million grant didn't start until April, and that's what really stepped it up. Because I think there was one clinician on the sheriff's staff to serve all 6 zones, and which is how do you do that? You can't do that. So I think, I've put in there that we need to address this. I think we have the resources to address it, but I would just hope that we can go ahead and pass this proposal out so that we can get this to City Council for them to consider during the upcoming deliberations on the budget. And that's why I've presented it, and that's why I ask for your support.
The one concern I have, and I hope you'll be able to work with me, is the budget formulated between Sheriff Williams and Sheriff Ivey contemplated a certain number of officers that they believed that they'd be hire and train within this current fiscal year. So my concern is, how do we factor in that contemplation of whatever plans they've put into place to deal with that population by recommending a much larger group of people that they may have?
Well, and that's where the whoever comes in as sheriff in November will have to take over from Sheriff Ivey, and hopefully if we can propose this to the City Council, if they adopt this proposal, then we're gonna have to work this out within the new sheriff, and the new sheriff may just say, I'm not gonna do it, and there's money in the budget to do this. If the City Council were to adopt this proposal, there's going to be $14.8 million sitting in the budget for new positions to fund these 148 new positions, but no will on the part of the sheriff. Now it becomes a political process of how do we get the sheriff to follow through on the policy that's been implemented by the City Council. And I don't know that answer to that question. It would set up an interesting dynamic.
Ironically, the Constitution of the state makes it very clear that the sheriff is the only one that has the authority to make hiring and firing decisions, and the legislature, since we've talked about it in previous commission meetings gave he or she budget transfer authority. So, yeah, exactly, July. So, a county commission and other counties or city council can appropriate, say, we want you to hire X number of employees and spend this much. A future sheriff, I'm not saying that they would, a future sheriff can say, nice idea, but no, and do what they want. But that's the balance.
But I think we can make the argument that fundamentally we know we're short of officers, and I do know that of the four candidates, I've heard one of them in a screening committee state that the candidate that made this statement said that they would address the staffing shortage in the sheriff's office. They agreed there was a shortage, and they were committed to beefing up. And I believe all four of the candidates for sheriff would follow through and implement the funding if we can get the city council to provide the funding. So,
I have first, I will second your motion just for the sake so we can actually formalize.
Bellman seconded.
Oh, you second. Okay. Sorry, I missed that part. Would you be okay with an amendment that would push off the first year from being this fiscal year to next fiscal year, so that way a new sheriff that will be inaugurated in November and a new mayor that will be inaugurated in July can fully flesh out what this 8-year plan that we're suggesting will formally look like in terms of how many of these officers will be detectives, people out on the street, that actually will deal with some of the deficiencies that you've identified?
Yes, to answer your question, yes. I'm happy to make that modification.
Yeah. That was a concern.
We can go ahead and present to the City Council that we believe this is a policy that cities should adopt in the next budgetary cycle.
Yes. Okay. So before we lose a quorum, I make that amendment as a motion. Can I get a second to that amendment?
Second.
Okay. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Now we're on the resolution as amended. You can't walk out the door until we vote on it. Any other amendments,
yeah,
suggestions for changes? All right. Is that if we adopt that as an amendment to mention that, I just want to make sure, Jeff, how can we get that into the final product? Because I know we can't use as a conduit to do work after.
I can put some language in the whereas clauses about talking about the importance of mental health and training and intervention and all of that.
But we can go ahead and pass this today with the provisos that we amend the resolution to be presented to the City Council. Is that correct, Jeff?
Well, you'll be adopting it right now. I'll do the whereas clauses. I will include everything that Dr. Chambliss has asked to be included. And then, but the final, therefore, be it resolved, we urge them to do the 140-80 year
Starting in fiscal 22, 23 year.
And then will you also incorporate what I was talking about with the new sheriff and new mayor too?
Sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Happy place?
Happy place.
I vote aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you. Thank you
very much. Any other commissioner comments? All right. The next meeting is September the 8th. We've definitely made enough comments. Motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Objections. We're adjourned. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you.